Save big during Labor Day at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances. Plus, buy more to get up to an additional 20% off. Shop even more savings with 3 Stay Green 1 cubic foot vegetable and flower garden soil bags for $10. This Labor Day, take care of your home for less at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 9/3. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Redacted. This week, you've got just one of the two team members of Redacted, but we also have Philip and David with me in the program, running the show. They will ring in, but mostly, you've got me, this gal. I apologize if you come here for Clayton, but you're in good hands. I'm a professional too. I'm Natalie Morris. Thank you so much for joining me. We have a lot to talk about though. Clayton or not, we have things to talk about because pretty much every French-speaking country in Europe is on fire. Why is that? What's going on? We have Ralph Schollheimer here to talk to us about that and whether or not this is really like, is it a racial story? Is it an immigration story? Is it a social class story? It's all of those things. We're going to refuse to boil it down to one thing and just spew BS on Twitter. That's what a lot of people have been doing. We're not going to do that, but the images are quite shocking. So join us for that. We also are going to rewind the tape. This is someone I've been talking about a lot. Gilbert Doctorow is an academic and a theorist on Russia. He's been warning us for over 10 years that the West is escalating Russophobia, that the West is provoking Russia into a conflict. He was right. If you rewind the tape, and we're going to have him explain that to us and tell us what's going to happen because it's terrifying times. And whether or not Europe has any balls, I'm going to say balls because there's no other balls in the room. Whether or not Europe has any balls to stand up to what the United States wants and actually act in its own interest. We also are going to talk about Maya Forstater. She's the person that really, you know, J.K. Rowling jumped into the gender debate on is her case, Maya Rowling, because she lost her job for saying that sex is real. She now has been awarded a big judgment. I'm going to give you an update on that case. Plus, was the pandemic planned? Redacted correspondent Dan Cohen has some shocking video from before the pandemic that preps us for the pandemic, basically as it happened. So I want you to watch this. You decide whether or not this is actually writing on the wall. I don't know. Let us know what you think. Redacted starts right now. All right. Thank you again for staying with, I want to say us, but it's me. It's mostly just me. It's me and the boys in the control room. We have David and Philip. Say hello, boys, if you'd like to.
Hello.
Hello, boys.
All right. So we only have David who will show his face. We still don't have Philip. Yeah. both have educated and interesting opinions. Thank you for joining me, David. Good to see you.
Mm-hmm, no problem. You as well.
I like your hair. Like, it looks like a headband going up and over.
Yeah, I didn't put my hat on today. I gotta go get it trimmed. It's a little longer than I like.
It's good. It's working for you. Thank you for joining me. And go ahead, Philip.
And if I can, I know you can't see me because I like to maintain my mystery, but Rumble, we are unable to connect to Rumble for some reason. We've tried several instances, so anybody that would normally watch on Rumble, we're working on that. We'll hopefully have it resolved by tomorrow, but it's an unknown error, and we can't figure it out.
Yes, we apologize for that. Interesting, though, that Rumble is down And social networks are being attacked in France. We're going to get to that story in a second. Before we do, I want to remind you that we have a newsletter. It goes with this show. It's sort of a companion piece. A lot of the pieces that we cover in this show are linked to in the newsletter with like blurbs about them. It's a great place to go if you're wondering, well, where's the link to that? I'd like to see it myself. That's why we have the newsletter. You can read it every morning. It's free. All you have to do is put in your email address and then you get what we're showing you here, which is the authentication email. And then you're off to the races. It comes every day that this show comes, Monday through Thursday. And again, it's free. It's a great way for us to keep in touch with you. And it's just a great way to keep up with these stories. And, you know, you can archive this stuff because the internet changes so rapidly. People just take things down. There was a story this morning in the newsletter about how in a live blog about how this Biden student debt program was struck down by the Supreme Court. And the New York Times was live blogging, well, here's some ways that you can get rid of student debt. One of the suggestions was die. You could just die. And they have since removed an entire paragraph about how death is a way to get out of debt. That's crazy. But the internet is changing. They'll say crazy things. It's like subliminal messages, you know? Anyhow, we keep that stuff in the newsletter and you can keep it and archive it for yourself if you like. Not just for that reason, though. Again, I think it's a informative little ditty and we make it for you. So you can subscribe again at redacted.inc. Once again, that's redacted.inc. Well, riots are raging throughout France and now Switzerland and Belgium. By some counts, there are over 300 fires on public roads in these areas, 300 burned vehicles, 34 burned buildings, 45,000 police deployed, many of them injured, hundreds of arrests. This all spawned from a 17-year-old Muslim boy last week with an extensive criminal background who was pulled over and fatally shot by police. The video went viral and prompted protests and riots and all kinds of civil destruction that we're watching now. So I wanted to invite political analyst Ralf Schollheimer on to discuss this issue because it is a charged one. It's one that we don't want to reduce to anyone's fault, but figure out what's going on here. And is there any fix for something like this? Ralf, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So can you give us a sense of what is going on at this hour and why? I know I gave you sort of a simplistic, like the spark in the machine, but what is this showing us about Western civilization and specifically France?
No, I think you gave a very good description, and maybe just for the viewers and listeners to put it even more into context. The number you mentioned, which is absolutely correct, right? There were 45,000 French policemen in action. And just to give a comparison to this, this is about the same number of troops the United States had in Iraq after 2011. So this is a significant number, right? I think very often this number is kind of like thrown out there so as if it's nothing remarkable. If the government has to mobilize what is more or less 3.5 infantry divisions to keep domestic calm, that's a major thing. So because there's a kind of this narrative forming that, well, it happens in some areas, in some suburbs, but overall, it's not a big deal. This is a very big deal. And the other thing we have to look at is there is the other narrative that says this is generally a problem with migration and integration. And that's partially correct. But unfortunately, and this is what you also, I think, correctly said, the harder thing to talk about, it is about specific immigration groups. To give you just one quick example, right? There are 500,000 Jews living in France. But after the terrorist attacks of 2015, where several Jews were being killed simply for the fact of being Jewish, like none of them went out and were burning schools or libraries or rioting in any way. Right. There is the largest Southeast Asian community in Europe is in France, right? As far as we know, none of them participated in these lootings and these riots. So this is an explosive mixture that has a very strong cultural element to it. Now, I know this is an uncomfortable topic, but the problem is that we cannot ignore reality and then hope to come up with solutions. And I think so the first step is to say, okay, there is something very specific about certain groups. That is, and I really want to stress this, it's cultural and not ethnic and not racial. And this is maybe what can give us kind of a glimpse of hope because culture can change. So I don't think that all hope is lost. But first, we have to name the problem.
And certainly it has nothing to do with Islam or religion. The common theme is said, oh, these are Muslim immigrants and this immigration group is a problem. And so I guess for those of us who want to humanize everyone, we think, okay, well, is there something, is there some like thread of powerlessness running through that group that is making people like this act out in this way? Is that a sensitive way to put it? Or I don't know what question I'm asking here is that, like, what is the crux of this group and that they're asking for?
No, I think you phrased the question perfectly. And this is, again, where we have to be careful and honest about what we're facing. One is, and this is a little bit the narrative that's particularly popular on the left, is it's all economic, right? These people have been left behind. They have no economic opportunities. They have no material support. Therefore, they are desperate. And this is basically, once there is a triggering event, like you mentioned before, the killing of the 17-year-old boy, once you have this triggering event, all this desperation bubbles over. Then you have the kind of right-wing narrative, which is it's all immigration. It's all Islam. It's all a purely cultural factor. I think the reality is somewhere in between. And what I mean by this is there is a cultural component because we have one problem to different degrees in the West is we no longer have any convincing narrative to integrate people into, right? What does it mean to be French? What does it mean to be Swedish? What does it mean to be German? Because the Swedes have problems with gang and clan violence in Stockholm and Malmö. The Germans have these problems in Berlin. And like neither Sweden nor Germany have a significant colonial history in the Middle East or in North Africa. So the colonial narrative doesn't really work. So that's the one problem. And the other problem is, of course, then these people look for a form of identity. They look for, you know, a community experience. And they find it then in religion. They find it in small acts of crime. So this is the problem. We have to think in the West, how can we offer something to integrate into? And that's the difficulty here.
Right. And so some of these parallels that we see in the West is that this is a George Floyd moment for the West. We see now these French nationalists coming in to defend their cities. And I guess we would compare that to the far right in America defending their land. These are like archetypes that we see sort of stamped out. It doesn't help for, you know, some Fortune 500 company to say, oh, but we stand for diversity and everything's okay. There's some kind of underlying inability of cultural assimilation that we must acknowledge before we can think about how to fix, I guess. Is that an accurate assessment?
No, I think it's very accurate. Right? You cannot have a society without some degree of social cohesion. And if we look at the numbers, kind of what is available, basically it is true that the French state in many ways, they say it has turned its back on these areas, on these banlieues, on those suburbs. But in many ways, they're simply too afraid to get into them, right? I think this is, of course, also very similar, as you mentioned, George Floyd in the US, right? Why police who does go into these areas has a, let's say, a looser trigger finger, and I'm not justifying it, but of course, because there's a completely different threat perception that is important because these are areas that are kind of divided up between, you know, drug dealers very, very often, between Islamists, between, you know, unstable homes. So there are a lot of these elements that, again, a very uncomfortable topic, but we have to face them. This is replicated if we make the comparison with the African American community in the United States. There are some parallels there as well, which nobody really wants to talk about, right? Whether it's the city of Chicago or whether it's the suburbs of Paris. So you have then this toxic combination of if police is there is the risk of clashes. But if no police is there, then of course criminal and Islamists have free reign. And to find kind of a solution to this is very difficult. I think it is possible, but the way how you would do it, and this is, I think, nobody dares to touch. You would have to run, and I say it careful, but I do mean it. And I think we kind of have to face up to this. It would have to be a program of almost brutal assimilation, right? You have to make sure that the kids go to school, right? You have to make sure that they don't descend into crime, that they don't descend into either criminal gangs or Islamists. Islamist gangs. You have to make sure that, you know, that they get work. In the worst case, one should even consider that you have work programs, not for economic reasons, but for social reasons. Integrate them into something. Give them, you know, public activities. Give them social activities where they have to work with French men and French women of other backgrounds. You need to turn, there's a very famous book of French history about turning peasants into Frenchmen that kind of tells the story of how the French evolved as a nation. And it's the same here. These people, many of them, by the way, who hold French passports, they need to be turned into Frenchmen. Otherwise, given the high percentage of foreign born you have in France and other parts of Europe, this is only going to get worse. And if I look at the reaction of the European, particularly French left, who is basically egging on these protests, which I think is an atrocious thing to do,
yes,
like the French left parties, that's only going to make this worse. And I think they make the wrong bet because they think, oh, these people are then going to all vote for us. They won't, because at some point you're simply going to have immigrant parties. You're going to have Islamist parties. And that's then again going to make the situation so much more difficult.
And that's where I see a strong parallel to the way the Democrats talk to the Black community is like, oh, yes, you're so powerless. We speak for you. Don't worry. It's very patronizing. And it's almost like they have no interest in actually rising up the achievement levels of this population because, oh, you know, run along, little kid. We'll speak for you. That's not going to empower anybody.
Well, if you just allow me to add on something to this, because it's a wonderful point. It's really what is usually called the racism of low expectations. Because if you look again,
I've never heard that term before. I'm going to write it down. That's big. We see that with the Supreme Court ruling last week of affirmative action and these tweets that went viral, like, you're never going to succeed now. Poor dumb you. Say it again. I'm going to write it down. The racism of low expectation.
The racism of low expectations. And you see it also in France. But if you look, for example, of graduates from higher education institutions in France, right? Immigrants from Southeast Asia grade at a higher level than native French people, right? But they're also foreigners. And about against whom they are racist and against whom they are not racist. You see in the United States, right, some of the most successful individuals are people of Nigerian background, of Indian background, of Asian background. So this narrative that, as you just correctly pointed out, right, so we tell one group of the population, whether it's Muslims in France, and even there's a difference between, let's say, Muslims from Iran, who usually do very well, and Muslims, let's say, from the Maghreb or from Algeria, which don't do so well. So there are these differences, but we pick one group and we want to keep them in permanent victim status. As you said, we want to tell them you can't do anything on your own. Everything is rigged against you. And I think that some groups, without naming names, but some groups want to get political benefit out of this, because the next sentence they say is, you are too weak to speak for yourself. You are too weak to succeed on your own. So you need us to do it for you. And this is, I think, an insidious thing to do to these groups and to these people.
Well, I can see one group already that's going to benefit from this, and that is the presidency of Emmanuel Macron, who has decided that social media must be censored in a way that the French government was already moving towards this. And this is a wonderful way to grab that power now. Can you speak to that and whether or not that will work and whether or not they're going to then give up that power? My guess is they won't.
No, it's the same trend you saw all over the West over the last years. Like, you look at Donald Trump, right? Instead of engaging with why people voted for Donald Trump, we need to get him off Twitter. We need to get him off Facebook. You see the same in Germany with their right-wing party, the Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, right? Instead of looking via about 20% of the population willing to vote for them, we have to start a new process to ban them. And now you see the same in France, right? Instead of talking about the problems, instead of talking about why these people turn violent, what the economic, cultural, social reasons are and how to address them, it is, let's ban communication, right? Let's clamp down on social media. It's the big attitude in the West is, instead of talking about the problem, let's ban talking about it. And that's, of course, because it's not going to go away. And the most radical elements, not unjustifiably so, they will say, if what we have to say is so dangerous that they have to ban it, it must be true. And I have to admit, even though I don't share this attitude, they are forgiven to think so.
Yes. Yeah. So where do you think this goes from here? We're just in Monday. The protests have raged over the weekend. Will there be any discussion, or is it just a militant state from here on out?
Well, we had a similar developments in 2005, and at some point it's going to go kind of die down, and then everybody's going to move on as if nothing has happened, when under the surface things are going to deteriorate further. The solution, and this is again true for all of Europe, Europe needs at the moment, it needs, and this of course includes also Great Britain, it needs a moratorium on, let's say, culturally difficult to assimilate groups. I know this is a horrible thing to say, but it needs to assimilate the people who are here. It needs to assimilate its Muslim minority. It needs to assimilate those people who came in 2015. Mm-hmm. That's an absolute necessity. And only if that is accomplished to an acceptable degree, we can once again talk about larger numbers of immigrants. But at the moment, we are way, way behind on integration. We are way behind on assimilation. Every commune in Europe, from Sweden to Germany to Austria to France, will tell you the same story. They're overstretched. They're underfunded. They don't have the schools. They don't have the social institutions. We have now a situation in Germany where public pools need private security services because they constantly have violence and gang fights, right? It's becoming more and more of a burden for average, including migrants, of course, for the average people who want to live a normal life. And yeah. Then, of course, they start to sympathize with those groups who have a more radical agenda, and these groups are on the far right. But this is whoever fears the far right, right? The current policies will only strengthen them. So if you want to kind of take away their support, solve the problems, solve the issues they're talking about. They are not inventing them. I really want to stress this. The right wing, whether it's the True Finns, the Sweden Democrats, the Freedom Party in Austria, the AfD in Germany, the Front National or the Rassemblement National in France, Vox in Spain, Meloni in Italy, they are not inventing those problems. They are there, but they're the only ones who speak about them. And this is the reason why more and more people vote for them.
Yeah, it's a simple question. How do people who are not alike live together in a way that respects exactly. both groups? Like, it's not a racist question. It's a, you know, the same thing everybody goes through when you get a roommate in college or what have you, you know?
Yeah. And it's, if you allow me this one concluding sentence, it's racist not to ask the question, because then you implicitly say those people cannot be helped. They cannot change. They are just the way they are, which is the most racist. This is exactly what a racist would say. Right? Yes. The racist would say we cannot do anything to help these people because this is just how they are. It is how they will forever be. I don't believe this. I know that you don't believe it, but of course it's going to take work, and it's also going to take certain pressure to kind of make these cultural changes to turn these people, as I said, into Frenchmen, into Europeans on the long run.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for this. This was, you know, it's not a comfortable conversation, but I'm glad to have had it with you. Where can people find you if they want to follow along with your analyst's work?
I just Google my name. It's the easiest thing. I'm unfortunately on every social media channel, and I try to have a very, very strong online presence, for better or worse. So if you Google Ralph Schollhammer, you'll find basically all my writings and everything I'm doing.
All right. Well, thank you again. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, that was an interesting conversation. It doesn't necessarily help people who are living under terror in this moment. And I see the comments in the chat right now that are saying, well, is it Macron's fault? Will he, you know, will we have his resignation because of this? Should they have instead voted for Marine Le Pen? I mean, those are interesting questions that the French are going to have to figure out and come to terms with if they are willing to talk about actually, you know, cultural assimilation and realizing what's happening with migrant groups. It's a hard question, but, you know, do you want to see your streets burn? Do you want to see your children terrorized, right? So this is something that I'm sure we're not done with this story, and I appreciate your comments. Philip, David, do you guys have anything to say before we move on? France on fire. What do you think?
No, I don't. I mean, it's just, you know, it was watching the footage we had there. It's like, it's so reminiscent of Portland, like during the George Floyd protests. So I appreciated that comparison to the two, because, I mean, it was very much like that, where it's just like smoke downtown, and it wasn't quite the amount of burning of cars and stuff, but
yeah,
you know, just like that, and there's no reason to believe it's going to stop anytime soon.
Right. And if the discomfort is still there, right, there's something still underlying and festering, and we see in these civilizations that refuse to acknowledge disparities of different groups. And so I think, you know, what hits me the most is that we're screaming about, like, well, let's be sensitive to the people who are doing this. And we never scream about the poor people that live in these neighborhoods who it's being done to, the store owners, children trying to go to school in those neighborhoods.
But also, like, just the people, just the fact that they'll let populations sit in absolute desperation like that for as long as they can, because they, you know, they want to make the people that are in charge want to make as much money as possible for themselves. But if you have the majority of a population all just absolutely desperate to survive, you know, they will lash out.
And
you know, it's like right now they're kind of aiming it at the wrong people. But, you know, it's like at some point the population, you know, France has a long history of the people kind of getting back for you know, being oppressed.
Right. Yeah. It's a crazy story. So thank you for your attention and your comments as well. All right. We're going to talk about Russia coming up, because NATO continues to provoke Russia with some kind of weird promise to Ukraine. The ambassador to the U.S. ambassador to NATO this week said, you know, we're going to offer Ukraine membership in a way that makes them feel better. That's not a real, like, stamp on the passport. It's just, we're going to make them feel better, because big NATO meeting is just next week. And Zelensky has said, look, I'm not even going to show up if I don't get a real invitation into NATO for Ukraine. Now, one of the guests that I have been keen to talk to is Gilbert Doctorow, because he's been writing about this since the early 2000s. He's been warning what will happen if this Russophobia continues, why we're being primed to think Russia is the bad guy no matter what, and what is behind that? Why? And what's here? Why NATO? Why this line in the sand? Who are the adults in the room? Is Europe? So anyway, I'm excited to talk about those types of things, because it's interesting. I finished his book over the weekend, and it's a long book. It's from 2014. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense in today's context, except as sort of rewinding the tape to see, oh, we've been primed for this. All of these things we think, Putin is a madman or what have you, these were all intentional. Our thoughts have been hijacked for a reason. And so, you know, if we are thinking about, like, how do we get here to this war in Ukraine? What do I even really know about Ukraine? We're going to talk about that in historical context and what this even means. Ukraine, NATO, all of that stuff. So we're going to get there. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at Ghostbed, because let's be honest, there are a lot of reasons to stay up at night, but a poor mattress should not be one of them. If you find yourself tossing and turning in your bed throughout the night, or if you're waking up in pain, it may be time to invest in a new mattress. Our friends at Ghostbed are a family-owned company who take mattress quality seriously. They've been making mattresses for over 20 years, and their quality shows in their craftsmanship. Once you lie down on a Ghostbed, you won't want to try anything else. Every mattress in the Ghostbed line is made with heat-wicking materials, so you stay cool through the night. With a 101-night sleep trial on every bed, there's no reason not to purchase one now. Ghostbed also has a customer quiz to help you find your perfect mattress, or you can even speak with a sleep expert who will help you make your choice. And you can ask all of those questions, like, I sleep on my left side, my husband sleeps on his stomach, or what have you. They're ready for it. They've heard it all. You can only imagine. So head on over to ghostbed.com/redacted right now to get started. And for a limited time, you can use the code redacted for 40% off site wide. So once again, that's ghostbed.com/redacted. Well, my guest today has been warning about escalation with Russia for over a decade. Gilbert Doctorow is the author of many books on Russian-U.S. relations, and he joins me today to discuss the latest in the conflict with Ukraine. Now, I've been looking forward to speaking with you a lot because I picked up your book last month, the one called Does Russia Have a Future? And it's sort of an anthology of you responding to anti-Russian sentiment since 2014. As a journalist, I found this like a string of breadcrumbs to pick up in order to rewind the tape so that we can figure out how we got here. Now, you made it very clear for years you've been saying that the U.S. is using Ukraine to get a war that they want and using NATO as a pretense. You showed how Ukraine was waging war in the Donbas for $8 million per day and how Russia was reluctant to get involved, just like they have been in Latvia. In Transnistria, I never can say that easily, and yet here we are. So let's start with NATO. I want to ask you about your response to NATO, because just this week, the U.S. ambassador to NATO said that next week's NATO meeting will make Ukrainians believe and feel something more substantial about their NATO membership. So that's a weird thing to say they would believe and feel something better. But can you explain why NATO is a red line for Russia? And what is the significance of Ukraine for NATO?
Let's start with the second half of that. What is the significance of Ukraine for NATO? Ukraine is on the border with Russia. It is a very short flying distance, the borders of Ukraine, from Moscow and from the other centers of European Russia. It is a remarkable platform for the United States and its NATO allies to apply pressure to Russia and try to subjugate Russia to its will. The going back to 2014, the decision within Crimea, supported by Russia, to remove itself from the Ukrainian state was an essential task for both sides, for Russia and those living in Crimea, because of the strategic military importance of Crimea, the main naval base of at Sevastopol of Russia in the Black Sea, supporting the Black Sea Fleet, and the thought that this territory would come into the control of the United States, which was in the cards after the February 2014 coup d'etat staged by the United States, that was unthinkable.
Right. Just last week, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the presidential candidate, said, you know, Russia does have its own security concerns, and that's just something no one ever says in the West. Like, wait, what? They're concerned about themselves? You indicate in your book that Russia would have joined NATO themselves, except President Bush didn't want a competing superpower inside of NATO. And Russia burned its bridge by voting against the Iraq War and made themselves the enemy of the U.S. And ever since, we've had this steady diet of anti-Russian propaganda that we've all been fed, that you were documenting for years past. Can you talk a little bit about this anti-Russian diet, mentioning maybe the Sochi Olympics and, I mean, more than just Stranger Things and Russiagate, right?
Well, the basic predisposition to hold Russia in an unfavorable light has been part of American political tradition for a long, long time. The Soviet Union was, of course, the other superpower, the greatest rival of the United States for 70 years. And that fact reinforced the basic predisposition of America to dislike Russia. For a period of 10 years, Russia was cuddly, Russia was on its back, and seemed to be knocked out of the superpower ranks. That made Russia something that you could accept as having a right to exist. However, after 2000, when under the leadership of Vladimir Putin, Russia began to reconstitute itself and to get up off the ground, it quickly became apparent that Russia was not welcome anymore in the United States political community, because it was once again a rival for global leadership. So this is the basic underlying foundation for the contest. As you mentioned, there are a number of high or low points in this last 20 years, and the 2003 Iraq war, Russia's position against that war. But remember, Russia was not the only country to come out against the war. More devastating, actually, was the French decision not to support the United States in the United Nations in its seeking the Security Council approval of its planned invasion of Iraq. Now, of course, there are things that you can do to your close ally and European partner, France, and also to Belgium, and also to Germany, that are much less dramatic than what you can do to Russia. You can stop buying you can relabel French fries freedom fries. You yes. can pour French champagne down the drain, but that's as far as you can get if you want to maintain your control over Europe. Russia was a different story. This 2003 resistance of Russia to the United States Iraq invasion set the countries on really on a path of serious confrontation. 2008, the Georgian War reinforced this confrontation, and it could have been almost as bad as what we see today in the Ukraine war, had the Turks not closed the straits to American warships and made it impossible for America to use its warships in the Mediterranean in what would have been a direct confrontation with Russia over its position in Georgia during that war. These are the flashpoints over the last 20 years. But of course, the most significant development is the one that you called out from the beginning, the dispute over the fate, the future of Ukraine. Is it going to be wholly absorbed by the EU and NATO, or is it going to be, as the Russians insist, a kind of bridge between East and West, mm-hmm. a buffer state, which is neutral and not threatening?
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about Europe, because as these battle lines continue to be drawn, Europe is presenting itself as like a bit character, like a, you know, kind of goofy friend that has no opinion of its own, or at least that's how I feel as an American expat living in Europe. Over a decade ago, you predicted that Europe would do what the U.S. wanted in a conflict with Russia, but begrudgingly so, and at their own peril. Can you comment on that?
Well, the Europe that I was describing back then is not the Europe of today. Today we have remarkable Europe leadership, or lack of leadership. And in a press conference 2 days ago, Sergei Lavrov commented on the European Union leaders as being неадекватные. Inadequate is a direct translation. Jackasses is getting to the essence of what he was saying.
Okay.
We have leaders in almost all of these countries who are not up to the task, intellectually, in terms of historical background and strength of character. With the death of Silvio Berlusconi a couple of weeks ago, Europe lost its last man of stature. We have pygmies running the various European states, and that has played into the servile behavior of the European Union vis-a-vis the United States. But there's another factor. When the Russians moved in to Ukraine in February 2022, the European Union was stunned. It mm-hmm. was unprepared. It discovered all of a sudden that it had no armies or military forces to speak of that could face up to the Russians' capabilities.
Yeah.
Now that is a stunning discovery, which was not foreseeable to the average person in the street or even to experts in the political commentary world. Because the budgets, military budgets, of all of the 27 European Union member states far exceeded, many times exceeded, the military budget of Russia. And so the question that has not been asked publicly, and certainly hasn't been answered, is where did all that money go? But the net fact was that the Europeans understood that they were a pushover for the Russian military, and they instantly all lined up begging the United States to take charge.
Yeah. I live in Portugal, and one of the main accomplishments of Salazar was that he kept Portugal out of World War II at great personal cost. And he has since been canceled, renamed bridges, renamed roads. And there is no appetite for neutrality. It's just gone. And I don't understand it. And so as a relatively new American expat, I've been abroad for 4 years. I don't completely understand it. Now, just today, Ukrainian foreign minister had warned that, you know, you don't want another Angela Merkel. Don't pull that again. What do you think that means? Because Angela Merkel was keeping Ukraine out of NATO?
I think so. Angela Merkel, or Mutti Merkel, was has been widely misunderstood or misrepresented to the general public. She was said to have been close to Vladimir Putin, and everyone made reference to her childhood in East Germany, where she would have learned Russian, and people spoke of her as if she were fluent in Russian, which is nonsense. She did not completely come under United States control.
She tried to steer middle course.
Yeah, she's trying to steer middle course and to save Germany taking some nasty decisions that America was trying to push on Germany, particularly this question of recognizing Georgia and Ukraine as future NATO members. But I'd like just to step back and say that Angela Merkel is also the one who was in charge in 2012 when Germany failed to renew its very broad strategic cooperation agreements with Russia. And that really was the beginning of the end of German-Russian rapprochement or close relations. So it happened under Merkel, but nothing dramatic that would call attention to you as a reader of the news.
Yeah. Now, one thing that I picked up on from your book is this Putin apologist line, which you brought out in 2014 as just propaganda to turn us away from anyone looking critically at the issue. I thought that was pretty new. And it feels like, as a Western consumer of media, that the West has successfully made it sacrilege to question the Putin is a madman line. It's just a throwaway. It's the same way we used about Saddam Hussein, even though he worked with the CIA for years. Can you talk about the success of this Putin apologist propaganda campaign?
Well, in my book, 2015 book, Does Russia Have a Future, I particularly brought this out with respect to Germany and what I saw at the Schlangenbad discussion group, a German Socialist Party think tank. Germany at that time was clearly sharing the same predisposition to treat anyone who wanted to hear or to consider or to disseminate Russian government thoughts on any given issue as a supporter of Putin and someone who was contaminated and outside polite society. But I'd heard this earlier in the States. In 2009, 2010, I was a visiting fellow at Columbia University doing some work on the book that came out in 2010. On great American thinkers about international relations after the end of the Cold War. And I attended many public gatherings on campus, gatherings that were organized or meetings that were organized by the Harriman Center, the Institute of Russian Studies at the time at Columbia University. And these were uniformly biased, prejudiced speakers and audience. And anyone who dared to raise a hand to just make a question mm-hmm. was roundly denounced as a stooge. There you have it. The United States took off its thinking cap and turned universities into kindergartens already in 2010. Europe followed with a very slight time lapse. The same thing I can say about neoconservatism in Europe. It is widely assumed that the following of in the EU of the values-based foreign policy and these other principles that are embedded in the neoconservatism that American political life has known so well since the 1990s, that these phenomena in Europe are borrowed, they were imposed on Europe, nothing of the sort. They have a home-developed neoconservatism, and I described that in several of the essays in the book that you're talking about. Carl Bildt was one of the former Swedish prime minister, was one of the very big voices in Europe in that period, 2014, 2015, and more recently also, he hasn't disappeared from the scene, spreading this neocon view, which entirely supports what NATO and the United States are doing in Ukraine now.
Well, I'll ask you just one more question, and then maybe I'll have you back some other time, because like I said, it's fascinating to me how much I felt like, oh yeah, I have been primed by this without asking questions about, you know, all of these sort of narratives. Escalation is something you warned about. It seems to be the name of the game right now. The West just keeps escalating. Now I feel like nuclear war is the new weapons of mass destruction. It's a trump card. You throw it down and you get your way. What do you think will happen next?
Well, you've noticed at the beginning that I've been warning about where we're headed going back 10 years. But of course, the whole time I haven't been walking the pavements with a sandwich board saying the end of the world is nigh. Nothing of the sort. We have been brighter moments and darker moments. Right now, we're in a darker moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, the risks which I had described in various essays are very much in front of us. The times are very perilous, and considering the geriatric patient who was in the White House, and considering the spineless leaders of Europe today, we don't have immediately in front of us political leadership prepared to cope with the risks we're facing. I'm very glad you mentioned Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and he is one of the few bright spots in the American political horizon.
Yes. Well, I have been following along your takes at GilbertDoctorow.com, and I really appreciate that and anyone else who wants to join me in doing so. And maybe you'll come back and talk to us more about this, because like I said, once you're presented with the you know, buffet that you've been eating of propaganda, you just start to think, well, what about this? What about Alexei Navalny or whatever? Like all of these things, you know, what's that about? And I feel like now we have homework to do of our own, given that we've been fed something that we didn't question. So I'm doing the homework. I appreciate you helping walk me through it and bringing this to our audience. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you for sticking with that interview. And again, I encourage you to seek out Gilbert Doctorow's work, because it is, like I said, it's like a breadcrumb of like, oh, we were given this, we were given this, we've been primed for this all along. The West knew about this conflict in Ukraine. They knew, you know, that Ukraine was waging war on the Donbas region. They've known this forever. They didn't seem to care. The West has an agenda for Ukraine. It has nothing to do with saving Ukrainian lives. So that's why we are a peaceful channel here, and we are trying to do our homework for where we may have been blind, where we may not have been looking in the right direction. So some of the pieces that he points out in this book are things that then I've gone back and looked at, like a Stephen Colbert piece about Russia, where they just sort of laughed it off like, ha ha, we're, you know, the U.S. is provoking Russia by taking Ukraine. Okay, you look over there, take the gold medals, like all of this ridiculousness. A documentary on called Crimea, The Way Home, produced by Russian state media, but also talks about how Crimea had set up an independence movement after the Maidan coup because they were being terrorized by pro-Western Ukrainians inside of Ukraine who were like literally traveling down to Crimea saying, we're coming to get you. If you try and be independent, you're in deep doo-doo. They were coming with weapons, and Crimea was ready to be independent completely. They had no idea that Russia was going to come in, and they had no relationship even for this. So these are interesting tidbits that I think it's worth us sort of, again, looking back at. And I appreciate that there's still archives like this while they still exist. We talk about on the show all the time, things that just disappear from our eyes. Yeah, David, go ahead.
Yeah, and I want to draw a parallel to the, you know, the whole McCarthyite time where I saw documentaries where like everybody was a socialist or a communist or whatever, and they'd have them in front of Congress testifying, did you go to this meeting and that? And it's like, it's almost like we always have to have some kind of enemy like that to cause fear, you know, to make people get on board with whatever foreign policy they want to enact at the time.
Right. Yeah. And I am afraid of the idea of nuclear weapons being the new weapons of mass destruction, because how many of us can like push back and say, I don't think that's true, or I think we're being dragged into something? Because as soon as you use death as a trump card, who's going to push back that you get power just by being the scariest? So anyhow, this is something we continue to talk about. Now, I see you guys in the chat again asking where Clayton is, because if you've come in late, you're like, where the heck is he? He's off for the next 2 weeks, and you are in good hands with the boys and myself. And so I appreciate you sticking with us. And again, I love the comments. Has Clayton been abducted by aliens? Probably not. I don't think that's the case. When we first got married, he gave me this crazy book about a guy who like kept getting abducted by aliens and would wake up in women's pajamas because they were getting experimented on. I'm sorry, I'm not poking fun. I'm open to everything, but I was like, oh, this is what you're into, huh? I wonder if that's.
It sounds a bit like a cover story to me, but you know,
I hold that,
you know, there's like whenever I hear like eyewitness testimony, I'm like, I have no reason to discredit it. I have no reason to believe it. So I just take it as that, you know, until I see other evidence. But secretly, I would be like, I'm pretty sure you're either cheating and hiding it or you've got some fetishes you're not talking about. But
that's who knows? Who knows? Clayton would be able to rattle off the name of that book because he's read like 8 of this guy's books. And I was like, OK, I'm open to this. I'm open to whatever. But I don't want to read any more about that. About this guy's book. That wasn't actually the first gift he gave me was Wonder Boys, the novel. And that was a more romantic gesture than the book about aliens. Just so you know, he is a romantic person and Wonder Boys is a fantastic romantic gesture, I would say. So, okay. So we're going to move on. We're going to talk about not romantic things such as stating your assertions on gender, and we're going to do that. And then we're going to talk about, were we primed for the pandemic? A video that our redacted correspondent Dan Cohen found is basically a blueprint for the pandemic released in June of 2019. And you draw a conclusion for yourself. It is one of those things where you're like, oh, it's getting really hard to give people the benefit of the doubt. But you let me know. But first, we want to draw your attention to our friends over at Moomoo. Because if you're an investor looking for an easy way to trade stocks, maybe you would like 16 free stocks. Well, with Moomoo, our favorite trading platform, there's no steep learning curve. It has a simple interface and easy to use. So even beginners can take advantage of the stock market in no time. Plus, it offers powerful tools often reserved for experienced investors like customizable watch list and advanced charting capabilities. And now Moomoo has added even more powerful earnings calendars, so you don't have to hunt and peck trying to find the earnings schedule for your favorite companies, such as Tesla. I believe Tesla stock is in this offering, so check it out. Tesla posted great earnings actually just this week, despite all the, you know, sort of wokies saying they didn't want any Teslas. They still order Teslas, so you can take that and you don't take that to the bank. Right now, again, for a limited time, Moomoo is giving away 16 free stocks when you open your account and make your initial deposit until July 16th. Even if you never do anything else with the account, you just keep those free stocks. Moomoo has zero commission trades, and the app looks amazing on every platform from iOS to Android to Windows, Mac. And they can help you trade with their advanced tools like Stock Screener and, again, Earnings Calendar. So open your Moomoo account for free today. Get access to zero commission trades and 16 free stocks when you open your account to make your initial deposits. Again, to learn more about this offer, go to redacted.com/Moomoo. Once again, that's redacted.com/Moomoo. All right. Well, I want to give you an update on an important case in the UK because a woman who was fired for saying that men cannot be women has won a judgment of over £100,000. That is, I want to say off the cuff, about $140,000 because the pound is strong right now. Now, this is an important case because this is the case that got J.K. Rowling in the hot seat when she decided to jump with both feet into the gender critical space. Here's the tweet that launched 1,000 ships. This was in 2019 when J.K. Rowling said, "Dress however you please, call yourself whatever you like, sleep with any consenting adult who'll have you, live your best life in peace and security, but force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real. Hashtag I stand with Maya, hashtag this is not a drill." So this is the tweet that got her called a transphobe. So transphobic, saying do whatever you want, but don't hurt women for saying that sex is real. Who this Maya is that she was standing for is this woman. This is Maya Forstater. She worked at a think tank called the Center for Global Development, and she tweeted about a debate based on Kathleen Stock's ideas that sex is immutable. Then Forstater was fired for this. Now, Kathleen Stock is someone we've talked about at great length recently. She's a lesbian who was hounded for speaking at, was it Cambridge or Oxford? I can't remember. One of the fancier UK universities. And they wanted to kill her, basically. And so we saw the footage of her needing bodyguards in the year 2023 to walk in to speak about intellectual honesty, because she has said, she didn't plan to say it, but she has said men cannot be women, and gender ideology can hurt women. And for saying that, she needed a bodyguard. For saying that, Maya Forstater was fired. And then for saying that she stood with these people, J.K. Rowling was witch-trialed. Now, worth noting that Forstater won her case for wrongful termination, but only after an appeal, because originally she lost her court case. And in her first court case, she was dragged out in front of a jury, and the judge ruled that her belief in biological sex was, quote, not worthy of respect in a democratic society. During the first trial, she was asked questions such as this: how did you come upon your novel belief that sex in humans is immutable? Wherever did you get that idea, darling? On what basis did she think male people could not be female? On what basis? Could she name a philosopher that agreed with her? Here is now, though, after she won that case, she got her judgment over the weekend. Here's how she was, the judge ruled in her favor. Compensation of £91,500. There's interest there. And this total sum payable. And again, some of it was sort of awarded on the basis of the fact that her employer had harassed her and harangued her and called her, you know, just dragged her out in front of the media saying she's an extremist for saying that men can't be women. And so would we say now that J.K. Rowling could say, I told you so? She stood with Maya. Maya has won now. I don't know. What it does mean, though, is that if your employer or you as an employer fire somebody for saying that sex is real and that a man cannot be a woman or vice versa, you could face an employment lawsuit and judgments such as these, because it is still legal right now in the UK to say that men are men and women are women and those two sexes are distinct. That's still legal in the UK. In the US, different story. A new law in Michigan would make it a felony to disrespect someone's gender identity. Just disrespect it. This is a bill that was passed in the House in Michigan and is headed to the Senate. It says that if you are guilty of harassing someone, according to this Michigan bill, you could face a fine of up to $10,000 and 2 years in prison. Now, you can't harass people based on certain things like sex, race, gender, and gender expression. Now, here's how they define gender expression. We get it. It's different than assigned at birth. If you have to say it, we know what you mean. And if you intimidate them, that means that you're willfully causing them some kind of harassment to the point where they feel terrorized, frightened, or threatened, and that the actually causes the victim to feel terrorized or threatened. Interesting, it says intimidate. Like, you don't have a right to intimidate people. It's not a constitutionally protected activity or conduct that serves a legitimate purpose, which makes me laugh because I'm like, have you met the Justice Department? It's kind of what they do, right? Intimidation is not, it's not a protected activity. It's not a free speech to intimidate. Does that mean then that it's illegal? Does that mean then that it's a felony, that it's punishable by $10,000 and 2 years in prison if you make someone feel a certain way? Now, we've seen how far these trans rights activists go to point out what is called hate speech or feel intimidated. You know, that is, it's a wide net, and it's impossible to prove, which means that it always exists if it's impossible to prove. Because I can't tell you how you feel, right? I can't tell you that you didn't feel any which way. If I say I felt this way, I felt it. It's a Trump card. So again, these things will not be our, so, you know, according to this law, it doesn't specifically say it. And I've seen some sort of YouTubers say, well, this means that misgendering somebody is a felony. It doesn't say that, but it does say that you're intimidating someone. So let's, in this instance, say that, you know, someone says, I'm a breastfeeding man. I do this. I'm a breastfeeding transgender woman, right? But biological men. And I'm doing it. And you say, no, you're not. And that's harmful for the child. And you're a man. Then that makes that person feel terrorized. Because in their head, they're a woman. And I don't like to hear this. I don't want to hear you telling me that I'm not a woman. I feel terrorized, frightened, and threatened. You can't prove that I don't, right? So I can see where misgendering would fall into this category, and they'll use it. Of course they will. This is a terrifying bit of legislation. It, again, has to pass the Senate, and then it'll go to the governor's office. Who knows? Who knows? Any thoughts on this, boys, before we move on? You don't have to.
I don't know.
Okay.
Sorry.
David usually has lots to say about.
Yeah, Rumble just. I'm on with Rumble again. They got it fixed, but are we going to still be able to do the last story on YouTube, or should I still get Rumble set up?
Can still go to Rumble. Yeah, if there's anybody there that wants to watch, then I definitely want them to watch, because this last story, it's a doozy.
I'm going to get it set up then.
Oh, okay. So you don't want to ring in on gender. That's one of your favorite things usually. Okay, that's okay. No problem. I've said my piece. Then we are going to move on to this bit about COVID in a second, because, again, this bit of video that Dan Cohen, our redacted correspondent, has unearthed is like it's a time capsule from the past. It's not supposed to work that way unless it's in one of Clayton's alien books or time travel books or one of the books he gave me about. He gives me crazy stuff, and that's why I'm married to him, because I read whatever people give me and weird stuff. Anyway, I won't tangent. This does feel like it's predictive of the pandemic before we actually live the pandemic. And I am super excited to have you watch this video and see what your comments are, because it's strange. We're not going to move exclusively to Rumble to do that, because, again, we've had problems getting on Rumble tonight. It was some kind of glitch, and we apologize if you normally watch us there. The comments are really funny. If you ever like keep them up simultaneously, because the Rumble comments are usually hilarious, and they're downing on YouTube audience. So we don't have that both today. But if you're normally a Rumbler and you've come over to YouTube, we appreciate you coming wherever that's decided to be. But before we do that, we want to tell you about our friends over at Lear Capital, because it's no secret, if you're tuned in, then you know that experts are predicting a recession. Layoffs are already happening, and the government is just printing money hand over fist, further devaluing the U.S. dollar. While last year was horrible for most investors, 2023 could be even worse. If you're not paying attention, that is, unless you were smart and invested in gold, then you were protected from losses while other investments fell. If the experts are right and we do get hit with a recession, then 2023 is looking even better for gold and silver investors. So if you're interested in investing in gold, then Lear will help you start purchasing precious metals or converting part of your IRA or your 401k into a gold and silver IRA. Call Lear Capital today at 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com. Again, if you buy 1 ounce of gold right now, Lear Capital is giving away a free ounce of silver. That's incredible. It's free silver that you can keep or sell immediately. There are lots of gold companies to choose from, and Lear has over 25 years of experience, thousands of five-star reviews, and a risk-free guarantee that gives you 24 hours to review your purchase before committing it. That's why Lear Capital is the top choice when buying gold and silver. So once again, you can call Lear at 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com to get your free gold and silver investor guide and receive up to $15,000 in free bonus materials with a qualified purchase. So again, go to LearRedacted.com. Well, how much of the pandemic was planned, and are there clues that show us this? Well, redacted correspondent Dan Cohen found one kind of accidentally. And he's here to tell us all about it. So first of all, Dan, how did you find this? And take us through it, because it's quite shocking.
Yeah, Natalie, I was doing research for a piece I'm working on about the lab origin theory, which I think fundamentally is some kind of psyop. But I came across this video that we are going to watch, which really adds another piece of evidence to the body of evidence, I would say, that shows that the COVID-19 response was planned out ahead of time, and we basically lived a premeditated plan. So everyone, of course, remembers Event 201. That's well known, the simulation of a pandemic held by Johns Hopkins University, the World Economic Forum, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That showed how a response to a supposed pandemic was gamed out, and then months later came to fruition. Well, so I've uncovered this video from the Council on Foreign Relations from June of 2019. Remember the Johns Hopkins University, the Event 201 piece was from October 2019. So this one actually predates it, 4 months. So this is from the Council on Foreign Relations from June 2019. Before we start, understand that the Council on Foreign Relations, or CFR, is the single most prestigious and influential Washington think tank. So the fact that this video was published by the CFR speaks volumes, and its corporate members, who it represents, are all the usual suspects, the mega corporate entities that are basically more powerful than many countries. So it's a representation of this supranational elite: BlackRock, Bank of America, Apple, Google, Meta, Facebook, Goldman Sachs. I mean, it's huge. Pfizer is on the list. It has a massive donor list of billionaire venture capitalists, including, of course, the Gates Foundation, among many, many others. So let's go ahead and watch this video from, again, June 2019, before the so-called COVID-19 pandemic began. It's titled, What a Zombie Apocalypse Can Teach Us About Pandemics. And the description reads, what would happen if one day the dead rose up hungry for human flesh and brain? This scenario has played out in movies and books for decades, but science fiction fans aren't the only ones giving some thought to the zombie apocalypse. The CDC, major universities, and even the Department of Defense have plans for the day the dead rise. Not because they expect it, but because it serves as a useful intellectual exercise for infectious disease and foreign policy. Although international protocols exist to prevent the rapid spread of disease, each country's individual policies, infrastructure, and interests ultimately decide the course of any outbreak, including zombies. So the CFR, CDC, Pentagon, and whichever universities they're referring to were not planning for a viral pandemic per se. They were planning a real military response for a fictional threat of a zombie apocalypse, or in order to make people think that a virus would be equal to a zombie apocalypse. So let's get started with the video.
Okay.
Zombies, the flesh-eating, brain-hungry monsters that ravenously attack the world until everyone is infected. Could such a frightening science fiction disaster actually happen? As far-fetched as it seems, according to what we know from lore and canon, zombieism would work the same way as infectious diseases like SARS, Ebola, and the flu. Once a person gets infected, they pass it from person to person via close contact.
So they're comparing SARS, Ebola, and the flu with zombieism. First of all, those are all very different viruses. The flu is a seasonal respiratory virus that everyone has had many times. And the treatment, as I don't know, any parent knows, or any just anybody in general, is rest in fluids. You get the flu, you stay home until you're better.
Right.
And Ebola, right? Ebola is not contracted the same way. It's not the aerosol droplets hanging in the air like the flu or a respiratory virus. It's transmitted through blood and bodily fluids. So the fictional threat of zombieism, of course, is completely different than any of those. But there we have the CFR video equating all of them.
Well, what they're doing is giving us the idea that our bodies are weapons and that we cannot be sure of what we're passing or contracting. That's what they're weaving through this thing that, yes, we should not equate. That's crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's keep going.
Okay.
As with any newly emerging pathogen, the search for a cure would be complicated, since its origins would likely be a mystery.
So of course they'll need a pharmaceutical product supposedly to combat this disease, which is of unknown origin to this day, right? Starting to sound familiar. Does this sound familiar to what's been going on?
Yes.
And what has gripped the media for, I don't know, the last 3 years to this very day?
Yes, absolutely. It's like we're reading a script that we lived.
Exactly. Okay, let's keep going.
Scientists believe the risk of such a devastating scenario is growing larger. People are building homes in new areas, living and working near unknown insects and animals, which can carry new unknown diseases, increasing the chances of a deadly outbreak that could possibly spread around the world.
So this idea that urbanization, basically cities expanding into natural areas where these wild viruses that we've never encountered are lurking and then causing pandemics, I remember this being promoted early on as an explanation that urbanization causes pandemics, and as if urbanization is this brand new phenomenon in, you know, the last, what, 20 years or something?
Right.
Here's Bill Gates, Gavi, promoting that same narrative. And if you search urbanization and pandemics, there are dozens of articles on this. So I don't know. It strikes me as a little bit odd that that narrative was in this video and then was promoted early on at the beginning of the pandemic.
Right.
Such a disease wouldn't adhere to borders or politics.
Okay, so such a virus would not adhere to borders or politics, except that's not what happened. The Canadian scientist Denis Rancourt has shown through studying excess mortality that whatever was killing people did in fact respect borders. In other words, it wasn't a virus that was particularly deadly. It was the government response. Those yeah. deaths were a result of policy. You can see that in maps he's shown of Europe, where in Spain, in certain areas of Spain, there were huge amounts of deaths. Meanwhile, in Portugal and in France and in Germany, there were not until later. So it's not the behavior of a viral pandemic. And similarly, there wasn't excess death in Canada, but there was excess death in a given period of time early on, in areas in the United States. And then you can see that by jurisdiction inside the United States too, state by state, depending on which areas locked down. So that is not the behavior of a viral pandemic or a zombie apocalypse.
Right, clearly.
It would require international coordination and decisive action. All countries are legally bound to survey and monitor for disease within their borders. But many poor countries simply don't have the infrastructure. And depending on where a zombie case was identified, the reaction could be very slow, allowing ample time for the disease to spread. A country might even attempt to hide the existence of an outbreak for political or diplomatic reasons, perhaps to avoid disruptions in trade and travel, and try to contain it quietly. But with insufficient attention to the issue, and with something as infectious as zombieism, a spread might be inevitable, and precious time for preparation while the outbreak was still nascent would be lost.
Is that not like the exact narrative we were told and continue to be told about China, that they covered up the virus and let it spread all over the world? And even they even have like the picture of some like dictator. You know, I don't know if it's supposed to be Hitler or if it's Xi or what, but I mean, keep in mind the CFR represents not only big pharma interests and the military industrial complex, but just the US power structure overall that sees China as this existential threat. And what better way to defeat it or smear it than to create the idea that it's responsible for this zombie apocalypse deadly pandemic.
Yeah, it's a bullseye for exactly what these power centers want.
Governments with plans for such an event and first responders at the ready would fare best. But without professionals treating and instructing people how to interact with infected individuals or how to protect themselves, the disease could spread fast. Amid an outbreak, the WHO would deploy medical staff and attempt to coordinate response efforts. But the WHO doesn't have the funding, staff, or resources to take the lead in halting a pandemic.
Doesn't have the resources, you say. Okay, where might one go and get those and grant themselves emergency powers to do so?
Exactly. The World Health Organization to the rescue with the US with US and European government money, and the Gates Foundation. Bill Gates is going to be the hero to stop the zombie apocalypse. I mean, isn't that basically just what happened?
Thank goodness for those power centers.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill Gates.
Individual governments would have to mount their own initiatives. Those countries would likely prioritize border security in their plan, regardless of WHO recommendations or law. They might lock down their borders and enforce travel bans to and from the center of the outbreak. And they might quarantine or isolate both actual and suspected zombies.
So there it is. They even put a wall cutting off China. They have like a giant wall to quarantine China. Somehow they knew that China would be supposedly at fault for this pandemic back in June of 2019, several months before any of this happened. And they knew that they would lock down and quarantine Europe. The CFR has like clairvoyant powers. It's uncanny.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you could have just written this in the year 2023 in arrears, but to have this before the pandemic, it's mind-boggling.
NGOs and aid groups would also spring into action, raising funds and sending medical staff to treat people. With numerous actors on the ground, it might be unclear who's in charge.
Does that not look like a reference to the loss of sovereignty, or the voluntary handover of sovereignty by so many governments to supranational organizations like the WHO? Is that what they're referring to? That they're saying, like, we're even going to basically supersede your government? We're going to be above them, basically dictating what they have to do? Are they not saying it? Am I interpreting that wrong?
No, they said it out loud. This was a plan.
Meanwhile, scientists and researchers would try to develop a vaccine or medication to halt the spread of zombies. But this could take months while zombies continue to bite, infect, and spread.
Okay, that is exactly what we were told was happening with COVID. They said they had to fast track the vaccine. They were going to use emergency use authorization, and it would be a miracle, and it would be the silver bullet that would end the lockdowns and the quarantines and the mass death, and then we'd move on to the new normal. So somehow the CFR predicted it.
And here we are in that new normal.
How did those medical products, pharmaceutical products actually work? Did they do what they were supposed to? No. So there's that too. They didn't predict that. That part was left out of the script.
We were supposed to have full faith in them. Right. Exactly. Right.
Ultimately, researchers think that if a zombie plague actually occurred, few would survive. More people in richer countries might make it out alive, but poorer countries would be decimated.
Right, because zombies, just like pandemics, only affect poor countries, right? Only the poor are susceptible to zombies that want to eat your brain. So another hint that something entirely different actually happened than what they're blaming this on.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So what can be done now to protect the world from this zombie future, or from another disease that behaves like zombieism? All countries need to develop the basic health infrastructure to identify pandemics when they start. More funding and improved international coordination are needed for stronger investigations into how diseases spread. With increased financial support for research, scientists can prepare vaccines in advance for known diseases with potential to kill. And when a disease strikes, they can create better lab tests to detect who is infected and who is not.
Better lab tests to detect who is infected. Is that like the PCR test that tested for all kinds of coronaviruses and jacked up the threshold count so a papaya or a goat would test positive? I don't know if you remember that, Natalie, the president of Tanzania, John, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation, but John Magufuli, back in May 2020, he did that incredible speech and he showed basically how phony PCR tests really are. He tested a papaya and a goat. He swabbed them and they came back positive for COVID. And then he suspiciously died not long after. So
I don't remember that.
It's an incredible video that really everybody should see. There's all kinds of suspicion about actually three African leaders who basically rejected the whole COVID protocol that was rolled out, and they rejected and died soon after. So I don't know what happened, obviously. There's no proof of that.
Now they're selling, at least here in Europe, they're selling dual tests that can test for COVID and the flu, that are just used with regular checkups. Now it's just like, oh, okay, let's test for both things. That also seems like a convenient new way to treat any kind of respiratory illnesses.
Right, and like, let alone whether you have symptoms or not. That's one of the other big problems with the PCR tests. Like you would never have, there are all kinds of pathogens in your nasal pharyngeal passage, in your nose, in your sinus, in your throat, that they could find at any time.
Sure.
But just because there's some tiny trace amount of something that is non-culturable doesn't mean that you're infected with it. It just means you just aren't normal. So that was part of this whole paradigm that was rolled out, that any positive tests of any trace amount of something means you're positive and therefore you have to quarantine, which is a total farce. So that's the same thing that they're continuing that you're describing.
Right. Yeah.
Disparities in global health must also be addressed. Poorer countries need stronger health systems and better preparation. Richer countries like the U.S. also have lots of room for improvement. No city in the U.S. currently has the capacity to treat more than a small number of patients infected with dangerous emerging diseases. An outbreak that infects just 50 people would likely overwhelm any American city. We won't be able to stop every new disease, but there are things the world can do to make sure it's far more resilient and ready for the zombie apocalypse or any other pandemic like it.
So I don't know. I mean, that video to me shows that basically every single aspect of the COVID era and the government response was planned out really to an incredible degree that I didn't realize before, and should make, I think, everyone suspicious, even more suspicious of the popular narratives, maybe that were censored before even, or, narratives coming at us from all angles for, different political currents and different political persuasions, that I think we're really being subjected to an incredible psychological operation. And in the description, they pointed out that the Pentagon is involved, the Department of Defense is involved, which the Department of Defense has been involved in the COVID response in every way since the very beginning. So, from lockdowns, quarantines, to the development of the treatments, every aspect of it is very much propagandistic. And I think this video really shows that we are living, as you described it, Natalie, as a scripted narrative that was preconceived. And there's another big piece of evidence.
It makes it really hard for even those of us who are like, well, that seems far-fetched. I don't know about that. It's a little out there. Maybe we just didn't understand and we all were doing our best and acting out of an abundance of caution. But when you see things like this, you think, no, this is too close to what we were prepped for. And it breaks apart that, like, well, we just didn't know narrative. It breaks apart this benefit of the doubt. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. That's some crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I agree totally. I think for a lot of average everyday people, you and me, we didn't know. And I really, you know, I was, you know, even wiping down my groceries from that I got from Trader Joe's from the grocery store at first, and I was masking and all this stuff. And it took me a long time to kind of get a hold of, well, to realize that I'd been propagandized and scared. I mean, it's about creating fear. That's why they use, I think, the term zombie apocalypse.
Right.
But it's just too over the top where it becomes absurd. So I think average people were doing their best and going along with it and didn't know better. And there was such an incredible amount of fear porn being pumped out in every which way, every media outlet, to basically make us to live in fear of our neighbors, to think our neighbors and our family members were existential threats to each other, and just have us in our homes consuming this, you know, terror media. The powers, you know, the CFR, the powers that be, the World Health Organization, the CDC, et cetera, they knew. And I think that's what this shows. And I think that's what Event 201 shows. So really our ire should be directed towards them.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for sharing that with us today. I am sufficiently freaked out, and also about zombies.
Thanks, Natalie.
Well, that does it for me for today for Redacted. Thanks for sticking with me on this solo show. Thanks to the boys in the control booth who are helping with that. I will be here again without Clayton for the rest of the week and the week after. Clayton will be back. I think it's the 16th of July, the third week of July. So you're stuck with me. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for liking and subscribing to the video. Make sure you hit that bell notification so you get notices when we're live every day, Monday through Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. We really appreciate it. And remember to join the newsletter at redacted.inc. Thanks again, and I will see you here tomorrow. Signing off, everybody. Bye-bye.